Hey everybody, it's Jim, and before I introduce Amanda Green, I want to play you in its entirety a song from her musical Hands on a Hard Body, because it's so beautiful. This is a song called Used to Be, sung by Keith Carradine, about the way America used to be and the way it is now.
That sign up there says Nissan, but where it's worn away, you can still read Chevrolet. Bought my 86 Camaro here, I still miss that car today. And over there where the stop and go sits was the mom and pop with the slow cook grits and the sweet iced tea with refills free and cups of joe and company. There used to be a sign up saying glad you came, and every little town around was as different as its name. Now everywhere you go, it all just looks the same. Walmart, Walgreens, Wendy, Applebee's, Starbucks, Stuckey's, Best Buy, Mickey D's. And that used to be the drive-in where you tried to make some time. And that used to be the pharmacy next to what used to be the Five and Dime. They sold ices at the counter, lemon, cherry, grape, or lime. Corner store, the barbershop, the library. Drive-in, the mom and pop, the bakery. Now this town's just a collection of some old guy's memories. Just a ghost upon a ghost of all these used to be. But if it looks the same everywhere you roam, tell me, how do you know when you've gotten home? How do you know when you've gotten home? One coffee cup, one Kmart brand, chicken nuggets served throughout the land.
The fresh bread smell from the bakery that used to fill my car.
The light from the all-night diner shining like my true North Star. And all the thousand other little things that make us who we are.
Walmart,
driving,
Walgreens,
mom and pop,
Wendy's,
Applebee's,
Starbucks,
library,
Sam's Club,
the Holly Tree,
Denny's,
the Honeybee,
Mickey D's, memories,
only memories of how we used to be.
Walmart's, Walgreens, Wendy's.
Gorgeous, right? I wanted you to hear the whole song because A, you probably haven't heard it. B, it is from a recent Broadway musical written partially by Amanda Green, who I talked to today. That song has some special resonance to me, and it brings a tear to my eye because I've spent so many years on the road where I go to these cities where they all look the same. Walmart, Applebee's, Olive Garden, McDonald's, it's all the same, and I miss the days when there was a difference. But anyway, Amanda Green is as close to Broadway royalty as you're going to get, and here's why, before I get to Amanda. Her mother is a famous actress named Phyllis Newman. I saw Phyllis in the revival of Follies at the Paper Mill Playhouse, and she was incredible, and I saw her in some other things. But Amanda's father is the lyricist and writer Adolph Green, who, with his partner Betty Comden, wrote just a few things like On the Town, Singing in the Rain, Bells Are Ringing, On the 20th Century, Applause. I mean, I could be here all night with what Adolph Green did. he met Leonard Bernstein when they, I mean, this is how things happen, you know. Adolph Green met Leonard Bernstein when they were both working in the village and Bernstein was accompanying Adolph Green on the piano. And then he met this woman named Betty Comden and they teamed up and the first thing they wrote was On the Town, which is really a musical comedy masterpiece. New York, New York, a hell of a town. Comden and Green were just musical comedy masters. And anyway, Adolph Green and Phyllis Newman's daughter, Amanda, grew up to go into the family business and has had great success. She has had three musicals on Broadway, High Fidelity, Bring It On the Musical, which was just nominated for a Tony, and Hands on a Hard Body, which was just nominated for a Tony for Best Score. Hands on a Hard Body is based on a documentary about these people doing a contest to win a truck, and whoever holds their hands on the body of the truck the longest wins the truck. But anyway, I know some interesting people, right? If you've listened to this podcast regularly, I'm really grateful that I know so many fascinating people, and Amanda's one of them. And I've known Amanda for quite a while, but this was the first time that we sat down and really talked, and I wanted you to meet her. So this is Amanda Green.
You couldn't get more, you know, suburban Americana with my upbringing, and you were raised on 81st and Central Park West,
mm-hmm.
in a big apartment.
Yes.
And by famous parents.
They were pretty famous.
I mean, that's what showbiz Jews. I want to know what that's like, because that's so foreign to me, because you're like, I picture your life like Eloise, you know, like living at the Plaza Hotel and spending time at, you know, Serendipity and.
No, I certainly had serendipitous moments, and I did go to Serendipity a few times. But I think it was a pretty normal childhood. I definitely went to, my parents hosted amazing parties. I thought their friends were amazing. I knew it back then, but you know, musical theater doesn't translate to cool, you know, things. You know, I mean, like,
really?
When I, you know, like, hey, Julie Stein was at our house, doesn't really, like, you know, get you much sway as a 13-year-old, but I mean, I was pretty.
Oh, you mean with your friends?
Yes, with my peers, you know.
So, but, Julie Stein.
You know, hey, Julie Stein and Cy Coleman were at the piano. You know, it did not make me a popular girl, but no, they
had incredible
parties and people around them, like Bernstein and Cy Coleman and Julie Stein and Steve Sondheim and all those people, Mike Nichols, and I went to tons of theater, and which I always loved, and I got to see things and hear things, and an annual trip to Serendipities. But it was not Eloise. I mean, I went to school. I did homework. I, you know.
Did you go to like Dalton or something, or a private school?
I didn't. I did go to private schools, but it was kind of a different day back then. I mean, like I have stepkids, and they went to public schools. But in my day, it was sort of more dangerous. You know, a little more wild and woolly.
You mean public schools were?
Public schools, yeah. And private schools were not. There was not a great divide. You know, I mean, private schools were pretty middle class, not like hedge fund things. It's a different day today. You know, I mean, it didn't cost more than a college tuition to go to preschool. So,
that's true.
Yeah, I went to a little French school for a number of years, and then I went to Performing Arts High School, mm-hmm. public school, and then I went to Trinity High School.
But see, Leonard Bernstein came to your apartment.
He did.
You knew him.
I did know him very well.
What did you call him? Uncle Lenny? Or
just Lenny.
Just Lenny?
Yeah.
Did you have any idea when you were young how great what your father was doing and what Bernstein was doing? See, because let me just, when I was a kid, I somehow got a hold of On the Town, the recording that your father did when he played Ozzy.
Mm-hmm.
You know that one?
I do.
And of course you do. And with Betty Comden playing
Claire DeLune.
Claire. And I couldn't believe the music. I couldn't handle it. I said, this is the most astonishing. And I think this was before I'd even heard West Side Story.
Mm-hmm. And the music's incredible. And there's a great a revival of it up at Barrington Stage right now, which is the best production of it I've seen in my lifetime.
Oh, you went and see it?
Yeah,
saw it.
It was amazing. Amazing.
Did you have any idea as a kid what you were being surrounded
absolutely.
By?
Absolutely.
You did?
Absolutely. Yes. My parents always felt were very proud of what they did, and I had a great sense of who Leonard Bernstein was and felt very privileged to be in that company.
Did you know this is what you wanted to do? Did you know you wanted to go into the family business, so
absolutely.
To speak? You did?
Oh, yeah, from like three.
As a what? As an actor?
A star.
A star.
Whatever that meant, you know, yes.
Did you want to be
sure.
a star?
Of course.
Really?
What else do you want to be? Well, I didn't, I mean, I wanted to do what they did. That's what I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. And your mother won a Tony, and she beat Barbara Streisand in her category.
That's right.
For supporting actress. That's an accomplishment.
It is.
Yeah, because I had first heard of your mom, of course, on Match Game. Mm-hmm. And whatever, you know, she was on To Tell the Truth, right?
Yeah, she was on that show often.
With Kitty Carlisle and everything?
Yes, yeah.
That's so cool. But I mean, did you start to just, how did this take place when you were a kid? Did you just start to, like, play the piano and take classes and...
I took piano lessons from the age of 6, and I sang in any chance I could get at anything at school. I didn't do anything professional, it was always my favorite thing to do. If I could have, you know, taken English classes and been in school plays, I would have been very happy. Didn't necessarily need the English class either. I just loved being a part of plays.
Yeah, well, me too. I did that too. I was in children's theater all through. Mm-hmm. All through. I was a Munchkin when I was 9, and I got to say, "We thank you very sweetly for doing it so neatly."
Well, there you go.
There you go. When did you write your first song?
I always like to say we wrote songs for and parodies for family occasions. So I mean, I always felt like I was always sort of writing poems and songs and I probably wrote my first song that for like my parents' anniversary when I was in college. You know, I'd written song parodies. You know, like when the toilet was flushed, I wrote it to just in time to leave my parents a note that the toilet was clogged.
Toilet's clogged.
8 a.m. It was at 8 a.m. this very morn. I was crushed because when the toilet flushed, you know, something that was so. It was always part and parcel of the. Of the environment.
Did your father ever sit you down and say, "Here's how you write a song"?
No, and they certainly never. They encouraged me. They never discouraged me. Although they would say what a terrible, awful business it was.
Yeah, well, that's what they all do.
And if you could do anything else, please do it. And I would bring him lyrics, and he would. He was very lyrics. He rarely had. Notes about. Sometimes if I brought him music, I'd say, "Well, this isn't very much." And he'd say, "No, it isn't. You know, you need to work harder on it."
Really?
Yeah, but he was very proud. And there's a story I love to tell that the first musical I wrote, I had a very dirty song, which was a gynecological exam set to music. And it had every euphemism for the word vagina in it. And just went, it was a patter song, and it just went on and on and on. And
I'm pregnant, and I'm here to see my gynecologist, Dr. Rebecca Hyman, for my 3-month checkup. Alrighty then, I think I'm ready to have a peek inside someone's vagina now. What are you looking for at 3 months, doctor? Well now, let me tell you. We start with the externals. Check for lesions on the lips. They should feel moist and beefy and not like two dried chips. Then we take a pap smear. We're looking for a sign of chlamydia or gonorrhea clogging your vagina. Next, we check the cervix. I know it's here somewhere. It should feel smooth and firm. It does. It's good and long. That's rare. Whoops! Your discharge is copious, yet nothing could look finer than the swollen, rosy uterus that's tucked in your vagina. All done.
Thank God.
Your vagina, vagina.
I was going for a walk with him, and I recited the lyrics to him, and I thought, oh, well, God, what is he going to think of this? And he was like, now, did you include box? Did you have box? What about muff? Did you have muff? You got snatch? You know, so that was his, it was the family legacy. It was a nice father-daughter moment. Yeah.
That's a scream.
Yeah.
How long ago did he pass away?
In 2002.
And how old was he?
He was 87.
Oh, so he was up there.
He was up there, yeah.
Well, that's great, though.
Yeah.
Because what a legacy he leaves, my God.
It's true.
I mean, and so the first time I ever saw you was at, that was the first time we met, was at the Bistro Award.
That's right.
And you got up and you sang a song, which was a country song.
Right. Every time a friend succeeds, a little piece of me dies inside.
A little piece of me dies inside. And I thought that was just the most hilarious thing. And it was like country.
Yes. Yeah, I don't know. You know,
it's like a lot of your music that I've heard
accidentally
has a country feel to it, and not a New York big city on the town bells are ringing.
Yeah, I like that kind of music too,
sure,
very much. I just, when I was in my 20s, I also went to college, and then I went to acting school, and I also found, like you, that it was like the auditions weren't happening. I was like, well, I can't make a career of this, because I was just, I mean, I had many jobs to support myself, and none of them were acting, and it wasn't,
What kind of jobs?
I was the development director. I mean, I had many shitty, can I say shitty?
You can say whatever
shitty,
the fuck you
I
want.
I can say whatever the fuck I want. You know, I mean, I was a coat check girl, I was a waitress, I was a telemarketer, I was a, all the things you do to survive.
What did you sell telemarketing? I sold typewriter ribbons over the telephone.
If I could tell you we never knew what we were selling, and we would call each other so we would look busy. My friends and I were like, hey, Johnny, did you hear about that 30-ring binder system they're selling over at Skalmart? You know, we had no idea what we were selling.
Exactly,
I don't
right.
know. I don't know.
Exactly.
And then I was a development director of a charity, the Robin Hood Foundation, for 7 years. So I had, real jobs. But it wasn't happening. So I started writing songs with a friend of mine, and I also started singing in cabarets. And that was a way I could employ myself and be up and singing. And I loved writing songs so much that I started writing more and more of them. And I sort of, the person...
So you sort of fell into it.
I fell into it, and I loved it. And the person who was floating my boat, the songwriter who was floating my boat the most at the time, was Lyle Lovett. And I liked, because I thought I wanted to be a pop writer, and he was writing funny songs, and they were country, and they were also contemporary. So I thought, well, here's a way I can write. I always liked writing funny songs. Here's a way I can do it. I spent a lot of time in Nashville and writing with Nashville songwriters. I would go down there, four or five times a year and spend a couple of weeks at a time and just have writing dates and write.
How does one do that? I mean, did you just know these people and you just went
you
down?
You do it through connections. I was in a part of a songwriting workshop and
I
knew someone there. And it's kind of, you go down there and you hear someone singing and you introduce yourself and you go on a date, you go on a writing date. So, or publishers would set me up and things like that. And then I went to the BMI musical theater writing workshop and I thought, no, this is really where I belong. Cause I'm not really a country songwriter. It's a very specific trade and market. And that's not what I wanted to do, was write top 40 country
hits.
You
didn't.
I didn't. And you have to, you have to sort of be in New York, or you have to devote your life to writing musical theater. If that's what you want to do, you can't dabble in it. And you also, I don't think, can dabble in top 40 country hits. There's a very specific world, and I don't think I really wanted to be part of that world.
I'm in comedy, it's like whatever world you want to be in,
you
have to be in it.
Yes.
Somehow.
Yes.
Somehow.
You can't dabble.
Just say, oh, well, I'll try this. Or
yes.
Maybe.
So I realized that musical theater was really where I was at home.
But you never set out to do this when you were a kid.
No, I never thought I'd write musicals like
so
my
you didn't,
dad.
So you never said, I want to write musicals like my dad?
No.
Never?
No.
And how funny that you end up
writing
not only writing them,
yeah,
but you've been nominated for this year two
yeah.
Tonys, right?
Well, yeah, Bring It On was nominated for Best Musical that I co-wrote the lyrics
right.
for. Yeah.
So you were nominated for Hands on Hard Bop.
Yes.
Okay, now, that show got great reviews.
Yes.
Why didn't it run? It just wasn't selling?
Yeah, I really think it was a marketing thing. But, it was certainly out of my control. I'm sort of too close to it. It's still too early for me to tell you exactly why I think it didn't do better. But I'm certainly really, really proud of... I'm more proud of that than almost anything I've done.
Well, that's... Where did you guys get the idea to write?
Doug Wright, who's an incredible playwright, came to me with the idea, and it was a long odyssey. It was based on a documentary, and we set out to get the rights to that, which we did. You meet with them, they have to trust you, and you have to convince them that
you have to convince them that you're not going to trash.
Absolutely. And we were not the first people who had knocked on their door. We
really?
Were the 10th or the 15th people. So it was a coup, and it was nice of them to give it to us. And then we also hired a private detective to find our favorite contestants from the documentary, and we wrote them letters, and Doug and I went and flew to Texas and met with them, and so it's been a really long, it was the making of it was as much a story. And then I was writing the music myself because we couldn't find a composer, and I never thought I'd write the music to a musical, but there was no one else to do it, so I just started doing it. And then I met Trey Anastasio, from the lead member of the band, Fish. We were fixed up on a writing date, and we...
You were fixed? I've never heard of this.
Well, we have
you
a mutual friend.
Fixed up on a writing
date.
We have a mutual friend who knew
Trey was sort of looking around for additional people to write with. And he knew me, and he thought that Trey and I would hit it off. And we met each other, and we hit it off, and we started writing songs a mile a minute. And then it was my husband who said, you know, you've been looking for someone to help you with the music. This is the guy. I asked him, and he had told me before I asked him that he'd always wanted to write a Broadway musical and had grown up going to see Broadway musicals. So that even though he was this the king of jam bands, I knew that he's a very sophisticated musician and schooled musician, and and that he wanted to do it.
So he was probably able to bring things into the piece that perhaps you would not have come up with.
Well, first of all, it sounds exactly like I wanted to sound, and I could never have made it sound in a million years, and I didn't know anyone else who could because I didn't want it to sound like Broadway country.
Well, you used a lot of different kinds of instruments.
He did. He's a genius.
He's the
and
one.
And also, yes, he made numbers. There were songs I wrote that I loved and we kept, and there were numbers where I'm like, I'm just treading water, and he made them incredibly exciting musically. And I mean, he's an incredibly exciting composer. So,
but that show's going to have a life.
Happy collaboration.
It's going to have a life all
yes,
around the country.
Yes, there's already like seven regional productions.
Because it's ideal for that kind of thing.
Yes.
You know, it's a musical about real people.
Yes.
Do you think...
All you need is a truck.
Huh?
All you need is a truck.
All you need is a truck. But do you think... Let me ask you something. Do you think that there is kind of a New York snobbery about musicals about Midwestern people?
I honestly do, actually. And
always kind of thought...
Yeah, and that. Also country music.
Right.
I don't think country music... and we really did... I mean, I'm proud of our score, and we really did work hard to not make it just generic country music so that when you hear the first four bars, you go, oh, I know what this song is, and you stop listening. We really tried to make it theatrical as well as being country. So, but I think that there's a sort of disdain for country music.
Well, it's like a disdain for the red states.
Absolutely.
You know,
it's
like
crackers, you know.
Crackers.
You know, someone referred to them as crackers, and I was like, that's as offensive as the N-word.
Sure.
You know? I mean, it's like, what are you talking about? These are people with hopes and dreams and, you know.
Well, you know what's funny? There's a play called Greater Tuna.
Yes.
You know that I was in a couple of regional productions. Nobody wanted to bring that to New York.
Mm-hmm.
I'd met the producer and I know the two guys that wrote it. And nobody wanted to bring that show to New York because it was too Southern and too white trashy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, it opens down at the Circle in the Square on Bleecker Street,
right.
And people thought it was the funniest thing they'd ever seen in their lives.
Right.
How did you come to write Bring It On? Did you just love the movie or something?
No, that was a case... I did love the movie, but that was a case where I was hired for it, and I was thrilled to be hired for it because the team... I was the last team member... hired for it, and it was Tom Kitt, and he and I had been looking for another project to do.
Because you did High Fidelity with
yes.
him.
Yes, and Lin-Manuel Miranda, who I absolutely adore, and Jeff Witte, who wrote Avenue Q, who I absolutely adore, and Andy Blankenbuehler, who had choreographed In the Heights, which I loved, and Alex Lacamoire, who was the musical supervisor on High Fidelity. So it was a team full of people that I really was excited to work with. So it was a no-brainer. It was an absolute no-brainer.
They just brought you on and did it. How long does it take to write a show like that?
In musical theater terms, that was a fast track. I think we started in 2009, and we did the first production in end of 2011, and regionally. So that was pretty fast. I may have my dates wrong, but I think it was like 2 years from starting to getting it on stage, which is very, very fast. And then we did many rewrites. We did a production at the Alliance Theater, and then we completely rewrote it, and then we opened it at the Amundsen Theater, and it did a national tour, and then we rewrote it again before it came to Broadway.
Was it supposed to be on Broadway as just a limited engagement?
Yes, and it was sort of never written for Broadway. It was never like, we're going to end up on Broadway. They wrote it to tour, and it was always like, well, if we get to Broadway, we get to Broadway, but that wasn't the...
And you got to Broadway, and you got nominated.
We got to Broadway.
And you got nominated for Best Musical.
That's right.
That tell me what that was like sitting in the I'm living vicariously through you here. I mean, what was that like after being raised by, I'm assuming, two Tony Award winners?
Yes.
I mean, what'd your father win?
Like five or six.
Five
Tony
or six.
Awards.
Your mother won just one?
That's right.
For Subways Are for Sleeping.
Right, right.
But it's so cool, you know?
It's so cool.
Because you're raised by two Tony Award winners, and then there you are sitting.
I was very upset because Hanson and Hardbody had just closed. You know, was it a few weeks beforehand? So it was a very mixed, like...
Bittersweet.
So bittersweet. So I was thrilled. But I was disappointed Hanson and Hardbody wasn't nominated for Best Musical because that would have meant that they performed on their number on the Tonys, and I really wanted the cast to have a chance to do that. So I had like two babies. So I was like, oh, Hanson and Hardbody didn't get nominated for Best Musical. Oh my God, Bring It On got nominated for Best Musical. You know, so that was thrilling, and it was thrilling to be nominated for the score. It was just thrilling.
I spoke to Doug Bean. You guys were both nominated in the same year for two different shows.
Right.
Because he was nominated for The Nance and for Cinderella.
Yes.
And you're nominated for Bring It On and Hands in a Hard Body.
Yeah, it was thrilling.
When's that going to happen again?
Oh, God, I don't, you know, who knows? That was just, you know, it is feast or famine, and all of a sudden, I couldn't believe that both shows were going to be on Broadway in the same season. It was just insane. I'd been working on Hands in a Hard Body for 5 years, and Bring It On for 3 years, and they just happened to... coincide. Yes.
That's so wild.
It was wild.
That's
very
so
exciting.
Wild. What is the thing you're the most proud of that you've written? Do you have a favorite child?
We just did a concert of High Fidelity, and I love the work we did on High Fidelity.
I love that show. I adored that show.
It was really great to do a concert of it and be able to feel proud of it. And so I'm very proud of that. It was incredibly cool for me to write music for Hands in a Hard Body because that was like I crossed a divide that I never thought I would cross. I just thought I'd always be just a lyricist. And so to write music that I was proud of and that songs people like to sing and, you know, hearing my song sung on a Broadway stage, music I wrote, was something I'm very proud of.
So. That's like really, yeah.
Yeah.
That's like with my novel. It's like people are reading a book that I wrote
right.
that don't know me personally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's like I've had a child that people like to talk to.
That's right. High school girls will be singing my songs and older people will be singing. It's great. It's nice.
That's really great.
Yeah.
So what are you working on now? Can you tell?
I can't really tell because there are things that I don't have the rights for.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm mostly meeting with a lot of people and just figuring out what I want to write next. I have a few really fun ideas, but none of them are far enough along that I can tell you about them.
How many albums of your songs did you release?
Just one. Just so far.
Just the one?
Yes.
That's the way to do it.
Because I want to do it, yes.
That's the way to do it. Are you going to do that again? Or
I would like to very much, yeah. Maybe do a solo album.
Yeah.
Because I had many, many... friends singing on it and guests, great, you know, Jesse Tyler Ferguson and Jessica Molaski and Billy Stritch and Brooks Eschmanskis and Mario Cantone, all sorts of great people. But it would be fun to do one myself, too.
But you've had such a ridiculous year coming off this year. I mean, are you just looking forward to maybe chilling out a little bit? Or?
Yeah, I am actually looking forward to having a summer. So I've been enjoying that very much. And I always like to keep busy, though, so I am. Writing and I'm writing songs.
And you're writing.
Yes.
Can you tell me if you had like a dream project? Like if somebody said, okay, here's, you can do anything you want. You can write any piece you want. What would it be?
I can't tell you because
you're trying to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. But I would like to one day write something that I could be in myself as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
really
can I ask you about the Playboy article about the Viagra weekend?
Sure.
So you are married to Jeff.
Yes.
And who's an orthopedic surgeon?
That's right. Jeff Kapp.
How did you meet an orthopedic surgeon in your profession?
I know. He is a friend of a friend, and he was staying with them for the weekend in East Hampton. And I was renting a room out there for the summer, and I went to the beach, and my friends were there. And he was there, and I thought he was very handsome, which he is.
So y'all say.
And and then this, I like to tell the story, this little girl ran up to him, and she was like, Daddy, Daddy. And I was like, of course, you know, I was in my early 30s, and he was too, and men like that are taken, you know, and he has a daughter, and his daughter took an immediate shine to me, and we were playing in the water, and I was holding one of her hands and he was holding one of her hands. We were swinging her back and forth. And I thought, oh my God, what am I doing? You know, I'm like swinging, you know, I'm like, I thought I'd sunk to a new low of, you know, coaching men. But afterwards, everybody was reading books on their towels. And he was reading a book called Mommy's House, Daddy's House, How to Raise a Child in Separate Custody. So, I high-five my friend. And but he didn't ask me out that weekend or ask me for my phone number because he was going through a divorce and he was sort of shell-shocked. But a few months later, his ex, I know her whole family, and his ex's sister brought him to hear me sing. And he came to hear me sing at Tavern on the Green where I was singing. And he came up to me afterwards and said he had a crush on me. And I said, well, that's good.
Really?
Yes, yes. So that's how we did it. And I love telling the story that I broke it to my parents. I said, you know, I dated mostly, you know, itinerant beachcombers and poets and people without, you know, with home, you know, phone numbers that changed every few months and addresses that changed.
Being able to go to your New York.
Well, so I said to them, and I'm dating a handsome, lovely Jewish doctor. And they said, well, what does he know about show business? Does he understand?
Are you serious?
Yes.
Are you kidding me?
No, they were like,
every
concerned.
Other Jewish parents would like have a coronary.
They were concerned.
He's a doctor. You know, when are we going to get you married? And they said, well,
they
what
were
is he?
Concerned that he really? Was like, does he get it? Does he really understand? Does he like it? You know, then of course they love him, and all of my family and friends call on him at will with, you know, it hurts when I go like this. Questions.
Oh, really?
Yes, they found out how very valuable having a doctor in the family.
Well, see, I remember seeing you guys at the Friars Club one night, and I asked him about my feet.
Uh-huh.
Because that was back before I found my podiatrist that saved me.
Yes.
And I said, well, Jeff, when I stand, it's funny. And you know, he just looks at me like, what the fuck do you expect me to do? Right?
Right.
But I remember you telling me that you guys somehow wrote an article for Playboy magazine about doing Viagra for the weekend.
Yeah, I did. Yes, I wrote an article. He and I took Viagra, and I reported back on that. And Hef loved it. I have a framed fax from Hef going, "More, we should get more articles from this woman. She's very entertaining and witty on this subject, you know."
How did this thing happen?
I mean, I knew, I was friends with a man who's actually friends of my parents, who was an editor at Playboy, and I thought, oh God, I really want to write something. And Jeff came up, as he does, most of my best ideas come from my husband. He's like, you know, you should tell him, like, we'll take Viagra for the weekend and you'll write about it. So I pitched the idea and they liked it, and we did. And the article was very funny and a success. There were two things. One is my dad's eyesight was very bad at that point. He had macular degeneration. So he kept saying, you have to read me the article. And there was no way in hell I was going to read my father an article about me having sex on Viagra. So he never got to read it. But also, once you become popular with that, they were like, well, what else will you do in print? So they had me do all sorts of, you know, we did tantric sex. I wrote like 4 or 5 articles for them until I ran out of things that I would A, do, or B, tell them if I ever did. And then plus he was my boyfriend when we started, and then we got married, and, you know, doing, you know, having sex with your husband is not exactly that titillating for the Playboy reader. So, but I did become sort of notorious for a while, and, you know, that, you know, you write one article about sex, all of a sudden you're a sex expert, and people are like, oh God, well,
all of a sudden
will you write about, you know, anal
Helen,
sex for my zine? And I was like, absolutely not, no.
Will you write about anal sex?
You know, I was like, no, no, never, thank you. So it was a short-lived career as a sex expert.
You ought to write a musical about that.
Yes, yeah.
When you write let me ask you something along those lines. When you write a lyric, are there any places you won't go lyrically? As far as, like, say, R-rated material?
No, I love R-rated material. I mean, you know, I've been writing musicals, and I mean, High Fidelity had a song that I'm very proud of called Pissing on Your Grave about, you know, it was a rap song, and it was very dirty. If it's dirty and funny, I'm all for it. I'm all for it. You know, it has to be funny.
It's absolutely.
But if it's, I love it. And my father, as I told you, you know, I mean, he and I, he had a filthy, filthy sense of humor. My
oh, he
brother
did?
Has a filthy sense of humor, and I do too. So yes, no, I'm all for it. but you know, it's so funny. I think it's underrated, filthy humor, because people just go, "Oh, you're just being a potty mouth," and you're like, "No, no, no, you actually have to be witty." And
there's
and
actually
filthy.
There's like the Book of Mormon is very creatively filthy.
Absolutely,
you know,
it's hilarious.
It's not just
genius.
It's not just filth for filth's
no.
sake.
Fuck you in the other eye. I mean, it's hilarious.
Oh,
hilarious.
I know.
Yes,
I know. Well, I wish that you'd... I'm sorry you can't tell me about what you're going to do, because I just adore your work, and I just...
Oh, thank
I really
you.
Want to know what it is.
Well, I want to do a big, fun musical. I mean, funny comedy. That's what I would like to do.
A big funny comedy.
Yes. You know, Hands on Hard Body was, like, the most serious thing I've worked on. And I was really happy to do that, too, to go there and to not... It has humor in it, and it gets very serious, and it deals with religion and faith, and... I really was very, very thrilled to do that, and now I'll be thrilled to do a big, big musical comedy.
That's great. Well, thanks, Amanda.
Sure.
Thank you.
That's fun.
Thank you again, Amanda. That was great, and you're hilarious. For those of you who are in or near Connecticut, I am performing my own show Friday night, August the 9th, at Bridge Street Live at 41 Bridge Street in Collinsville, Connecticut. That's Friday, August the 9th at Bridge Street Live, 41 Bridge Street in Collinsville, Connecticut. And the number is 860-693-9762. If you're in the area, I hope to see you there. I'm taking July off. I'm not doing any performing this month, but in August I start up again. So hope to see you there, and thanks for listening. Check my records, check my phone.